Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views.
Welcome back to News and Views. I'm Rob Schofield. One of the biggest challenges facing North Carolina's public education system is the massive teacher shortage that's continuing to plague almost every school district. And sadly, a State Board of Education member and former North Carolina Teacher of the Year, James Ford, observed in a conversation we had back at the start of the school year, it's not a surprising development. Between the combination of low pay, extremely tough working conditions, and a general hostility that many ill-informed politicians have directed toward the profession, Ford says many teachers are simply saying they've had enough. Despite this tough state of affairs, however, Ford says there are steps state lawmakers and education leaders can and should take to woo teachers back to the classroom. And while they're at it, bring greater diversity to the profession. Well, James Ford, welcome back to News and Views. It's good to have you back with us after a while.
Good to be here, even if virtually.
Yeah. So much going on in the public education world these days, and you're one of our state's leaders in that area. One of the things that's front and center right now is, you know, we've got teacher shortages, not just teachers, but bus drivers and all kinds of staff. Talk to us about what do you think is behind this and what should we be doing to address it?
Yeah, well, I got to say, I'm not surprised. Some of the causal factors predate the pandemic, obviously. These are jobs and vocations that aren't incredibly well compensated in North Carolina. So I feel like that disincentivizes people to enter the field or to stay for longer periods. But on top of that, like, I'm old enough to remember during the lockdown when we were praising teachers, heaping accolades on their heads and just telling them how incredibly valuable and important that they were. And then out of nowhere, this campaign of sorts, disinformation campaign, really, that really tried to pin so-called critical race theory and grooming and all these things on them. And who wants to teach in an environment like that? Yeah. I mean, transparently, where they're being held accountable for things that aren't even true and just being lambasted in the media. So consequently, you get folks who don't want to enter or stay in the profession. And I think that, you know, the added stress of all the things we were asking of them just, I think, put them over the edge. So I get it.
Here we are in a state in which I've seen studies that show the gap between what you can make as a teacher and what you can make in the private sector with a similar education is among the biggest in the country. We always think, oh, well, let's compare teacher pay to other states. But if it's the real comparison is what folks can make in the private sector. And so teacher pay has clearly got to be a factor as well, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. And in a lot of ways, I feel like it's been a design for failure since I was in the classroom. This has been a long trajectory of kind of chasing career teachers out of their profession. It just doesn't seem like something that people can do for a long period, even if they want to anymore.
One of the issues that's been front and center in recent days is this whole idea of master's pay. It's another area where the state sort of retrenched. It had been an advance that had passed earlier, I guess, in the decade, maybe even in the last century, that we would give teachers a boost in their salary if they got a master's degree. The current leadership of the General Assembly removed that a few years ago. Now there's a proposal from the Professional Educator Preparation and Standards Commission. They're actually saying, wait, let's bring this back. And we heard from local superintendents saying, I need something to work with here to try to keep people in the profession as I try to fill my classrooms. Is that something you think would make sense, getting master's pay back on track?
Absolutely. And we never should have gotten rid of it. I was Teacher of the Year when it was eliminated. It never made sense to me then. It doesn't make sense now, you know, for no other reason than the market demands it. I mean, we always talk about market principles, right? Like you can't get the quality or the education level of teacher in the classroom unless you compensate them for that level of degree. And, you know, the oppositional argument is always, well, it doesn't make them teach better. But I got to say, that's an arbitrary argument that we only apply to education, to your point. If you do that in the private sector, if somebody gets a master's in business administration, an MBA, we don't say, well, are you a better business person? We only reserve that argument for teachers. And so I just think the market demands it now. People want to be compensated for investing in themselves, and it only makes sense.
There's another idea that's kind of floating around right now in the, we're talking about, some people call this idea of merit pay, but they're also talking about this idea of teachers who may only have an associate's degree, or perhaps they've come from the military and that's their experience, and that will sort of de-emphasize the idea of getting a four-year college degree. Maybe we can provide some other avenues into teaching as a means of addressing the shortage. Is there any merit there? Anything worth looking at? Or is that just bringing less qualified people into the classroom?
So I'm an advocate as somebody who came to the profession from another profession. Mm-hmm. Opening up the windows, the doors, you know, the air ducts, you know, however anybody can get into the profession. And I don't feel like that's necessarily antithetical to having quality candidates. It's also proven to diversify the profession as well, as a lot of particularly Black men tend to come from other vocations and, you know, lateral entry mechanisms. So I feel like creating as many on-ramps in the profession is good. Obviously, that discussion is controversial for other reasons, which, you know, I think deserve, you know, some more scrutiny. But this notion of pulling from all places and creating as many pathways and routes into teaching is something that I think we have to entertain, again, just by sheer demand. You know, you got a shortage, you got to find a way to get other folks into the profession. And I don't think we have to compromise quality to do that.
We're talking with James Ford, who's a longstanding member at large of the State Board of Education. And he's also executive director of CREED, which is the Center for Racial Equity in Education. And James, you've talked about teacher diversity. That's something I know that CREED has worked on and done extensive research around, and the need for more teachers of color in North Carolina. Can you remind our listeners why that is so important and why it needs to be a part of this discussion of the teacher shortage in our state?
Yeah, the long short of it is it's beyond even making a more pretty picture, right? This is not about having a more colorful palette from which to paint. Really, it translates into tangible benefits for certainly students of color in terms of decreased suspensions, increased identification and gifted and talented, increased attainment on specific assessments. But also, you know, white kids benefit from having a more diverse teacher workforce as well, because, listen, I mean, we live in a cosmopolitan, you know, pluralistic society, and you're going to have to be able to work across lines of difference. We advocate for it and have studied it. We also have a network of educators of color across the state called Teaching in Color, where we try to create a community, because we know a lot of teachers of color, depending on what region of the state they're in, they leave because they feel isolated and they don't have a community. And so we try to create that programmatically. But I mean, it's important. The state looks like that, but the teaching workforce doesn't. And so we got to try to make them match as best as possible.
I think there's a bit of mythology out there that if we put too much emphasis on diversity, quality will suffer. But what you're saying is quality actually goes up if we add diversity to our teaching workforce.
Isn't that ironic, don't you think, to borrow Alanis Morissette's line? I mean, I don't like the two being put in opposition to each other, because, you know, I feel like inherently, whether intentional or not, that's like a racist argument, right? That, so one correlates, discussing teachers of color correlates with quality. Why would you assume that? We don't question that when we're talking about a majority white workforce. So, yeah, absolutely. It just so happens that when you bring in a more diverse slate of candidates, that the overall quality improves.
Let's move to the subject of the pandemic, which has had such an enormous and devastating impact on our public education system in so many ways. We've alluded to the fact of the challenges it posed for so many teachers, and probably resulted in a lot of teachers leaving the profession. But one of the big things we've got to deal with going forward is the learning loss and the recovery for our young people, as we, I guess, more or less think of ourselves as now being in a post-pandemic world, although obviously it continues to linger. I wonder if you have any thoughts about things, you know, we need to do. As I understand, it's going to take years to get us back on track.
One thing I want to do is not to normalize, but to situate what I would like to call disrupted learning less than learning loss, but that's semantics, is that not to excuse it, because it's obviously urgent. Some of it is pre-existing and this merely exacerbated it. But I don't know what we expected. I mean, to be honest, like, to have the level of disruption on a global scale that everybody in every school system really across the globe endured, and that we wouldn't even break stride, the expectation we wouldn't break stride, that the students wouldn't be impacted, I don't think was realistic to begin with. Now, to be clear, we want to mitigate that. But students endured a collective trauma, right? Schools were shut down. And, you know, when we get new assessments or something, we instantly set the expectations and we say, well, there's new assessments. The benchmarks are probably going to go down this year. We expect that. But when it's a global pandemic, we're not expecting disrupted learning. So again, I'm not excusing it. But what I am saying is, let's be clear here that it's not like teachers didn't do their best job or that.
Sure.
There's a big difference between folks who went into school and those who didn't go on-site in the school. We endured something traumatic. And so it's to be expected. And yes, something, it needs to be measured. I'm glad that the Office of Learning and Recovery is doing that. They're doing amazing, groundbreaking research that North Carolina should be proud of. And we have to wage interventions. But folks, doesn't matter what school system we're talking about here. This was something we were going to have to respond to, because we endured a global pandemic. And I know that there's controversy around acknowledging that, but it's a fact. And all hands on deck to respond to that. But some of this, we just couldn't help, by being honest.
Yeah, I think that's something we're all becoming aware of. I wonder, you know, obviously, as you say, it's an all hands on deck response is required. I wonder if there are particular parts of the response that you think need to be lifted up? I know we've talked a lot about mental health of our students and the need for more staff to deal with those kinds of needs in our school, counselors, psychologists, nurses. Is that, I presume, one part of the recovery process?
I think it has to be beyond sort of the obvious, the academic interventions and the increased dosage of like tutoring and learning opportunities is, like you mentioned, those larger, more societal factors. Like if nothing else, I feel like the pandemic revealed that schools are not just schools. Then in many ways, they're fixtures in the community. You recall when school districts shut down effectively and, you know, the schools had to deliver lunches. So what does that tell you about the role beyond academics that schools play? So social and emotional supports are a big part of it. I don't use the term trauma loosely. I think that continuing to provide, you know, mental health services on site at the school to allow students to check in, nutrition services. It just so happens that, you know, schools are a vital part of the social safety net and that those things correlate with student achievement. So if we want to improve the outcomes, we're going to have to respond in a more holistic fashion.
We're coming to the end of our time with James Ford, who serves as a member at large of the State Board of Education, and he's the executive director of the Center for Racial Equity in Education. I want to talk to you about your service on the State Board of Education. It's an interesting job you've got there. You serve in a very diverse group, a very politically diverse group, but it seems that the State Board of Education has had, notwithstanding our divided political times, some success at times in finding common ground and working together. Now we have a proposal at the General Assembly to transform the State Board of Education into an elected body in which people would actually run for office and, I presume, have fundraising and make promises. And I wonder what your thoughts are about that, whether it's some states do that. Is it a system perhaps that North Carolina should consider, or is that something we want to keep in the box?
No. I want listeners to know is that the state board is set up the way it is based on this North Carolina state constitution. So it's been that way for, you know, 100 plus years. And transparently, the folks who are proposing it, I think, recognize what you're talking about, that we've been able to have what I would consider some success, but others may not. And those others perhaps may be behind the notion that we need to change out the members. And one way to do that is by making it an elected body. But I'm of the feeling if it ain't broke, don't break it. And so, you know, it's always been this way. As you mentioned, it's not like it's doggedly partisan. You know, we have folks from different gubernatorial tenures and so across party lines. And so I myself am a nonpartisan board member, although I was elected by Governor Cooper. But, you know, we don't always agree. But we've been able to, I think, in many ways, lead the nation with our strategic plan and with some of the reforms we've been able to do. And so unless that's something you don't like or something you don't view as progress, I don't see a reason why I'm trying to revise it.
James, folks might want to check out Creed and learn more about this organization that you lead. Is there a way they should do that? Or do you have any recommendations there?
Sure, sure. If you're interested in continuing to broach more topics of race and education explicitly, you can feel free to check out the Center for Racial Equity in Education, also known as CREED, at creed-nc.org. Check out all of our initiatives, our programs, our documents and research. We've got some cool stuff coming down the pike. So I just appreciate the platform and the ability to talk more about the work that we do.
Well, we appreciate your service to our state and your leadership for our state. Thank you for all you do. Hang in there. It's tough work. It's the Lord's work you're doing there, man. We really appreciate it. And I hope perhaps we can talk later this year about some additional rebounds and successes in our public education world. Thanks for all you do.
My pleasure. Thanks again.
Coming up next, a holiday season conversation about hunger in our state and an easy way for all of us to help out. Stay with us.